From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the American West of myth and reality. We'll feature an interview with the Dean of Western Writers, Wallace Stegner. He wrote about the people who settled the West and the generations that followed. Stegner died 2 years ago. Journalist James Conaway, who studied writing with Stegner, will talk about how the land can still inspire the same independent spirit it did a century ago. And actor Harry Carey Jr. will tell us about making Western movies with the great director John Ford. Also today, rockabilly. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Carl Perkins. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Iraq is hinting that it could reject a new United Nations offer to let it sell some of its oil. The Security Council has approved the sale of up to $2 billion worth of oil each 6 months. The UN would supervise the sales. The money would be used to buy food, medicine, and other supplies for Iraqis suffering under UN sanctions that were imposed at the end of the Gulf War. Iraq rejected a similar deal in 1991, calling it an infringement on its sovereignty. It's not clear if it will reject this new offer. 6 people were killed in southern Egypt today when suspected rebels opened fire on a busy village street. NPR Suni Khaled reports from Cairo.
A 3-year-old girl was among the latest victims of the country's 3-year-old conflict between government security forces and the militant Gamaa Islamiyah rebel group. Egyptian authorities said the girl, 2 women, a policeman, and 2 other people were killed when suspected Gamaa gunmen fired on a crowded street in the village of Nawai in the troubled Minya province about 160 miles south of Cairo. More than 700 people have been killed since the Gamaa Islamiyah launched its armed campaign to topple President Hosni Mubarak and install a strict Islamic regime. Most of the clashes have occurred in southern or upper Egypt, where guerrillas have staged hit-and-run attacks against security forces. Despite a recent government crackdown against suspected militant strongholds, clashes between the two sides have continued. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
Israel today sealed its borders to the occupied Palestinian territories in advance of the Passover holiday. Thousands of extra troops were deployed in anticipation of possible anti-Israeli violence. The closure bars nearly 2 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza from entering Israel. The heightened security comes 5 days after 2 suicide bomb attacks. France joined the United States today in accusing Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic of frustrating international efforts to strike a settlement in Bosnia. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French Foreign Ministry spokesman Richard Duquet said President Milosevic bears responsibility for the degradation of the situation in Bosnia. Duquet said the contact group continues to run up against an obstinate position on his part. Officials from the United States, France, Britain, Russia, and Germany visited Belgrade this week, offering a partial suspension of sanctions in exchange for recognition of Bosnia. But Duque said Milosevic had refused. The contact group is trying to extend the fragile 4-month-old ceasefire after April 31st. Officials fear that if it's not extended, all that war could break out and inflame the Balkans. Duque said the contact group will meet again soon. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Entertainer Burl Ives died early today. He was 85. His agent says Ives died at home this morning with his family. This is NPR. 7 major U.S. oil companies reportedly underpaid royalties to the federal government over a 3-year period. A published report says the royalties amount to more than $29 million. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Washington Post today reports that the underpayments took place from 1990 through 1993. The report also says the Interior Department agency responsible for collecting the royalties has done little to recover the lost money. A nonprofit watchdog group says an internal report by the Interior Department put the amount of lost royalties at around $29.5 million. But the group says the amount is probably much higher. The Project on Government Oversight, which obtained a copy of the internal report, reportedly has accused the Interior Department's Minerals Management Service, which collects the royalties, of having a sweetheart relationship with the oil companies. The oversight group says MMS has been looking for excuses not to collect all the money that the government is owed. An MMS spokeswoman has denied those charges. She says the agency will take aggressive action to collect the additional revenue if the reports prove to be true. The underpayments reportedly involved Texaco Incorporated, Shell Oil Company, the Mobil Corporation, Atlantic Richfield, Chevron, Exxon, and the Unocal Corporation. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
South African President Nelson Mandela has fired his estranged wife again. This is the second time in 3 weeks Winnie Mandela has been forced from her cabinet-level job. Mrs. Mandela sued after she was fired the first time. President Mandela reinstated her, reviewed her case, consulted with other political parties, and again fired her. Japanese police are on high alert. Some department stores are planning to close, and hospitals reportedly have been told to stockpile antidotes to nerve gas. The measures are in response to a warning by the leader of the religious sect suspected in last month's nerve gas attack on Tokyo subways. The sect leader is predicting a disaster this weekend in Tokyo. Police fear the sect could launch some kind of attack. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. City kids from the East, like me, learned about the American West through Western movies and TV shows. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we look at the West of myth and reality. The late Wallace Stegner was called the Dean of Western Writers. He didn't write about Western myth. He wrote about the landscape and how it's been changed by development. And he wrote about the people who settled the West and the generations that followed. But as one critic wrote, Stegner's main region was the human spirit, how one achieves a sense of identity, permanence, a sense of home, in a place where rootlessness and discontinuity dominate. Stegner was born in 1909 and grew up in a family that moved from place to place across the West. Stegner won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1971 novel, Angle of Repose. For 26 years, he headed the creative writing program at Stanford University. Stegner died 2 years ago yesterday at the age of 84 as a result of injuries sustained in a traffic accident. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with him in 1992. He read an excerpt of his book, Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, Living and Writing in the West. This is from the introduction, in which Stegner wrote about the true believers and wishful thinkers who settled the West, people like his father.
I know that historical hope, energy, carelessness, and self-deception. I knew it before I could talk. My father practically invented it, though he qualified more as sucker than as booster, and profited accordingly. He was a boomer from the age of 14, always on the lookout for the big chance, the ground floor, the inside track. As a youth, he tried the Wisconsin and Minnesota woods, but found only the migratory wage slavery that's always been one payoff of the American dream. He tried professional baseball, but wasn't quite good enough. In the 1890s, he floated out to North Dakota on the tail end of the land rush, but found himself in the midst of a 10-year drought and ended up speculating in wheat futures and running a blind pig. If you believe that the world owes you not merely a living but a bonanza, then restrictive laws are only an irritation and a challenge. When it became clear that Dakota's promises were indistinguishable from Siberian exile, my father dragged us out the migration route to the Northwest. His goal then was Alaska, but again he was late. The Klondike rush was long over. The survivors had straggled back. For a while he ran a lunchroom in the Washington woods where the Seattle suburb of Redmond now is. The loggers cut down the trees and left the lunchroom among the stumps. By 1914 we were up in Saskatchewan, part of another land rush, where for a change we would be in on the ground floor and make a killing growing wheat to feed Europe's armies.
Do you think of your father's personality as being typical of a certain kind of restless loser who populated the West?
Not always a loser. You know, he was characteristic, I think, but sometimes they were losers and sometimes they were big winners. He was a product of his times, and though I used to resent him a great deal, I find that now I feel rather sorry for him. I think he was made by his times. At the end of a frontier, when there was no longer the kind of frontier opportunity that for so long had been part of the American consciousness, And he tried a lot of things, and none of them worked, or very few of them worked.
So did you really resent it when you were young, and every time he had a new scheme, you had to move?
Well, he not that so much as he was a frustrated man, and sometimes he took out his frustration on whatever was handy. But that too, I can understand. I'm sometimes frustrated, and I take it out on some people, too.
You're right. My father wanted to make a killing and end up on Easy Street. I wanted to hunt up and rejoin the civilization I had been deprived of. Where did you go looking for it?
Oh, school and the public libraries, primarily. There was a big division between my home life, because neither of my parents was educated even through high school, even to high school. So that there was no background of cultivation, reading, anything else. Though my mother was a reader, she didn't know what to read. She had no guide. She would have had a good deal of cultural capacity, you know, if she'd had any guidance, but she didn't. And I got mine from school and from the public libraries, where I took out 7 books a week and read most of them.
Writer Wallace Stegner is my guest. Had you grown up on the myths and the folklore and the cliches of the West, you know, the cowboy stories?
Oh, sure. I grew up not only on the myth, but among cowboys. When we moved to Canada, we were in the tail end of a period of cattle raising, which had been pretty well wiped out in 1906 and 7 by a terrible winter. But in the protected edge of the hills where we lived, there were still cattle ranches. And lots of cowpunchers still working on ranches, hired men on horseback. They weren't the romantic figures that the myth made of them. They were also, as a class, I should say, very macho, somewhat callous, somewhat brutal. Nice guys in a way, but brutal. And they also had a code of hating the crybaby, hating anything unlike themselves, despising anything womanish or oversensitive.
There might have been no room there for somebody who spent a lot of time reading, like you.
Well, I don't know. I got into the cowboy business quite a lot as a boy, but by the time I moved out of it, I was a little tired of it, because I had some little physical defects. My hands were always cold, for one thing, and you can't live in Saskatchewan with cold hands and like it. things like that. So that I resented sometimes the harshness of the code, though I was always trying to live up to it.
But what about reading? Where did that fit in? I mean, for the kind of brutal macho code that you're describing, that doesn't seem to fit with the boy.
There wasn't any reading up there.
Yeah.
Up in Canada, you know, there was no public library. Every family there may have had 3 books. We traded them all over town. Sometimes they never came back. My father, at one point in his life, got excited about, I guess he'd seen a Shakespeare play, so he bought a set of Shakespeare from a traveling salesman. We had that. Hmm. We had a few things like that. Mostly what we read was magazines, I suppose, and later when we got onto them, Tarzan stories and things like that.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, but when I was young, my dreams were about being a cowgirl. I mean, I would literally dream,
yep.
You know, about riding a horse and wearing a leather outfit and, you know, the whole Western myth. I grew up watching Westerns and the movies and on TV, and I just loved them.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, like, growing up in the West and knowing actual cowboys, what effect those kinds of movies and novels had on you? You grew up before television.
Yeah, sure. I grew up a long time before television, and I was never actually very, very taken by the Western myth, because I knew how far it was from the actual facts. A cowboy's life is spent punching post holes and branding and castrating and things like that, and very hard work and very low pay, and his celebrated liberty is generally the liberty to quit his bad job and go get another one just as bad. In terms of his migratoriness, his placelessness, his uprootedness, he was very often as bad off as a contemporary crop worker. And he's not a romantic figure in life, though very often real cowboys imitate their mythical counterparts and try to think themselves into that role.
We're featuring an interview from our archives with the late Wallace Stegner, recorded in 1992. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Wallace Stegner is my guest. I'm interested in hearing how you've seen the West change as a literary place. You once wrote, there are thousands more federal employees in the West than there are cowboys. There may be more writers. At what point in your life did the West start to become a place that was considered to be a place that had writers living there, writing about the region with a distinctive voice, as publishers from the region, publishing those distinctive voices?
That came pretty late in my life. I had graduated from college, I think, at the age of 20 or 21, before I ever saw a writer. It seemed to me that writers were people who lived a long time ago and a long way off, and it never occurred to me that I could be one or should be one, even though I liked to write. And it was encouraged a little bit in school. I suppose it never occurred to me really to take seriously the notion of being a writer until I went away to graduate school in Iowa, and there I was offered the chance to write some stories for an MA thesis and jumped at the chance. And, you know, a couple of those were published in little magazines or so, and that's the extent of that. And that was the middle of the Depression, and I couldn't stay on. There was no job outside, so I stayed on in school, but I couldn't stay on just to be a writer, so I took a PhD in American literature. And that pretty well killed the writing impulse for several years. It takes a long time to get over that. But about 2 years after that, I was back teaching in Salt Lake, and I sat down one afternoon and wrote a story in about 3 hours about Saskatchewan. And somebody, I guess the Virginia Quarterly, bought it, and then I was hooked. But that was pure accident. In Iowa, I had met a few writers, and I had certainly got a notion that writing was something that happened among contemporary living people. But it still hadn't jarred my consciousness that I could pretend to compete in that area.
So you said that the West became a place identified with writers, or writers identified with the West. Later in your life, when did you really feel that starting to happen?
Well, not for quite a while. I lived in Cambridge, Mass. For a while and taught at Harvard, and I met a lot of writers, some of whom were from the West, and I certainly had my mind opened up to possibilities. I guess I myself considered at that point that Western writing was some inferior, second-rate genre. I didn't have very many pretensions as a writer myself, though I had written a couple of novels. And when I wrote The Big Rock Candy Mountain, which was about the West, that more or less typecast me. By the time I had come out to Stanford, which was right at the end of World War II, there obviously was much more going on, and the GI students who came to Stanford showed up with a lot of talent and an enormous backed-up flood of energy and enthusiasm. That was the time when I really began to get enthusiastic about the possibilities in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And when we founded the writing program at Stanford, which is still going.
Yeah, well, I think you headed that creative writing program at Stanford for about 26 years. So, I mean, it's probably fair to say that you had a lot to do with nurturing a lot of the writers.
I hope I had some. Yeah, I hope I had some effect. I'm sure I had some little effect. Not necessarily by teaching, but by example, because by then I was pretty deep in writing about the West, both as history and as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing only, you know, about what I knew and what I liked to write about, and there was nothing very deliberate about that. It just turned out that way.
You know, writing requires such patience and reworking, and it seems like as a writer you'd have to have the opposite kind of temperament that your father had, your father always looking for a bonanza to pan out and moving to the next place. How do you feel you got the temperament necessary to write, given the background that you grew up in?
Well, partly because I was pretty much in constant rebellion against my father, so anything he did, I would do the opposite. But also, I suppose, getting a PhD teaches you patience. Believe me, you sit a long time just looking at books until the type begins to run and blur, and sitting at looking at blank walls and listening to blank voices. Patience is something learned to. When you have a book to write, particularly a long book, a novel, you have to go there 7 days a week, 4 hours a day, sit in that chair, and one of the earliest things you have to learn is to keep your seat in that chair, or don't vacate it very long. Just get up and walk around and come back and sit down. That's something that I think the profession itself teaches you. If you're going to stay in it, you have to learn it.
Mm-hmm. You taught at Stanford for about 26 years, the creative writing program. How do you think your teaching was different when you retired from what it was when you started?
It was tireder. There are some occasions when you're teaching a writing class, which has to be Socratic. You know, you can't tell them how to do it. You have to sort of help them find how to do it, which sometimes after 2 hour seminar would leave me feeling as if I'd carried the whole class up four flights of stairs on my back. That gets wearing, and sometimes, of course, the class doesn't meld. It just doesn't blend. It never comes together. I don't know quite what magic and chemistry is involved there, but you know, 6 out of 7 or 8 times it would be wonderful, a really exhilarating kind of class to teach. And once, maybe 2 or 3 times during my 26 years, it was just a load, just a load.
Do you feel that you did some of your students a favor by telling them not to write?
I hardly ever had the nerve to tell somebody not to write. You're dealing with such sensibilities that any harsh criticism of something so intimate as a piece of fiction that somebody is determined to write is very hard on the soul of the person who has to receive that criticism. Sometimes it would save them a lot of trouble. To be told, no, I don't think you have a speck of talent. You have sometimes you're intelligent, straight A plus students and so on, you still can't do it. The gift is not there. And without the gift, there's nothing much that can be learned. You can't teach people much. I have discouraged some young writers. I think they needed discouraging. But they were not the kind who were passionately devoted to their art. They were, essentially, they liked the idea of being writers, but they really didn't have that drive to write. So I could discourage them without killing them off. But some writers I would be very, very careful not to discourage entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Let them find out for themselves over a period, long, painful period of apprenticeship that didn't produce anything. That's the only way it would be psychically sound, I think, to tell them, let them tell themselves.
Wallace Degner recorded in April of 1992. He died 1 year after our interview, at the age of 84. A new edition of his book, Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, Living and Writing in the West, will be published in June. Harry Carey Jr. played a part in creating the myth of the West. He was a regular in director John Ford's stock company. Harry Carey Jr. appeared in 9 Ford films, including Rio Grande, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Wagon Master, and 3 Godfathers. He followed in the footsteps of his father, Harry Carey Sr., who was one of Hollywood's first Western movie stars and was best known for his roles in John Ford movies. I spoke with Harry Carey Jr. in 1989 and asked him about filming those epic John Ford scenes with the cavalry fighting the Indians.
We loved it. It's sort of like, I imagine, a good athlete feels the same feeling before a baseball or a football game. It's a challenge, and the unexpected is always the best. Ford was very lucky that way. I think he got the best action of any director I've ever worked for.
Well, how are these things choreographed? Like, how much would you rehearse it? And how well would it actually work in the final shoot? Because it seems like it would so easily become chaos in one of the big battle scenes.
Well, Ford didn't rehearse those things. You can't when you've got that many horses and Indians and cavalry and everything involved. But he had a tremendous talent and gift for communicating with large groups of people. And even though he could be tough personally, one-on-one with actors, I mean, he picked on John Wayne a lot. He was marvelous with the extras and with the Indians and with the Navajos and all of the extra guys that they hired out on locations like up in Moab or Monument Valley, wherever. And they all got to know him like he made them feel like they were playing a very important role in the picture. And so he had them so keyed up like a really great football coach with a football team. He'd have them so organized and told everybody exactly what he wanted. It was all clear in all of our minds, and then you just couldn't wait to do it. And when you heard that gunshot, all hell broke loose, you know. He'd always have, like, 6 cameras or 5 cameras on a scene like that. You know, he just didn't rely on one camera. You know, he'd have them stuck all around on top of hills and everything so that he could get intercut with different things.
Were you ever hurt?
But it was a wonderful feeling before a scene like that, because in those days they didn't have the walkie-talkie things, you know, like they have in all the war pictures now, and the ADs, the assistant directors, carry these, you know, on their belts, and they can talk, even if they're 2 miles away from the camera, they can talk to the director. In those days, you rode out to wherever you were before the stampede or before the big cavalry charge, and you'd be like a half a mile or a quarter of a mile away from the director, and then you just have to wait until you heard a gunshot, and then when the director shot the gun off, then you started charging. It was a great feeling. It was very exhilarating.
Did you know who you were supposed to be shooting or who was supposed to be
shooting
you?
And one of the things that happened, like when you Western actors finally got, you know, you use blanks, of course, I'm sure you know, but when you get on location, you're using local kids or local guys, and they get these blank pistols and you can get hurt with it, powder burns, you know, and this big wad comes out and hits you right in the eye or in the forehead. And I've seen guys look right at you and then shoot you, you know. And Wayne would always make a big speech. He'd say, shoot in an empty space, because on the camera it doesn't look like you're, you know, it looks like you're aiming at somebody. But he said, don't point your guns at another person. Shoot at the empty spaces. But they never heard, you know, and you had to be careful because somebody'd shoot you right in the face.
Harry Carey Jr., recruited in 1989. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on the American West on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our archive edition on the American West. Writer James Conaway looks at how some of the old West is still with us. Also, rockabilly. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Carl Perkins. He hit it big in 1956 with Blue Suede Shoes. Ed says he's more than a one-hit wonder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza have been banned from entering Israel during the week-long Jewish holiday of Passover, which begins today. Thousands of Palestinians who regularly cross the border are affected. The closure follows two suicide bomb attacks near Jewish settlements in Gaza last Sunday. The BBC's Matt Fry reports from Gaza.
Although the closure was widely expected, it's underlined the severe problems faced by the Palestinian authorities in controlling the self-rule area around Gaza. In the last 4 days, over 300 suspected Islamic extremists have been arrested. A military court handed down its first sentences against members of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the two groups who claimed responsibility for last week's bombings. Caught between Israeli demands for tougher action and the growing popularity of Hamas, the Palestinian self-rule government under Yasser Arafat is sacrificing human rights while trying to escape the spiral of violence. According to several leading commentators, the ingredients are being prepared for a Palestinian civil war.
Matt Fry reporting. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin says Israel will dismantle some Jewish settlements as part of a Palestinian peace accord. Rabin told an Israeli newspaper he has no plans to remove any settlements before 1999. He has avoided talking about the subject before. Rabin says Arab bombing attacks highlight the vulnerability of the settlements. The prime minister also says he'll continue negotiations with the PLO, despite low public opinion. He says he won't decide policy based on a survey. U.S. Air is disputing a report from its auditors that questions whether the airline can stay in business. The airline says despite its financial problems, it has enough cash on hand to continue normal operation. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The accounting firm KPMG Pete Marwick says U.S. Air has recurring operating losses and a net capital deficiency, and it says there is substantial doubt whether the airline can continue as a growing concern. The warning was included in a letter attached to U.S. Air's annual report to the Securities and Exchange Commission. U.S. Air has been losing money for the past 6 years because of high labor costs and competition from discount carriers. Ridership has also suffered in the past year because of publicity that followed a series of plane crashes. The airline has been trying to cut costs and recently won major wage concessions from its pilots union, but the auditor's report suggests that the changes may not come soon enough. U.S. Air officials insisted that they have enough cash on hand to continue operating. This is Jim Zaroli reporting.
President Clinton has taken the first official step toward re-election. He has filed papers with the Federal Election Commission. He's declared himself a candidate for president and has organized a committee. This is NPR. Japan's central bank, in an attempt to fight the crippling effects of the plunging U.S. dollar, has lowered a key interest rate. The Bank of Japan has cut its official discount rate by 0.75 point to a record low of 1%. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The government worked through the night to issue a spending and deregulation plan designed to curb the soaring yen and ease its impact on Japan's economy. A high yen makes Japanese exports expensive overseas and slows recovery at home. But today's cut in the discount rate makes the yen less attractive to investors, driving down its value. In an attempt to reduce Japan's huge trade imbalance that is at the root of the yen's rise, the government also agreed to step up its deregulation plan to stimulate domestic demand. But bolder measures, such as specific targets to reduce the trade surplus, were rejected, and that apparently has disappointed market players, who viewed that as the strongest signal Tokyo could send that it was serious about curbing the rising yen. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
President Clinton and First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton have filed their tax return with the federal government. The White House released the president's tax return, which shows the Clintons paid more than $55,000 in federal tax on an adjusted gross income of nearly $264,000. The return shows the Clintons overpaid their taxes by $14,418. The Clintons have decided to get a refund of about half the money this year and apply the rest to their taxes for next year. A published report suggests Nations Bank could be eyeing Chase Manhattan Bank. The Wall Street Journal says Nations Bank is open to a merger with Chase that could create the country's largest bank. But the paper says Chase executives don't much like the idea. Chase is the sixth largest U.S. bank and is involved in many foreign countries. The chairman of Nations Bank says the holding company would favor the combination. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our archive show today is about the legend and reality of the American West. James Conaway was captivated by the West because it's the province of American legend. Cowboys, gold miners, gunslingers, and other loners looking for fortune or freedom. His imagination was also captured by the idea of public lands that have been preserved from private ownership. In the mid-80s, he left his Washington Post job and took off for the West to see how the legends compared to reality. His book about the West, The Kingdom and the Country, was published in 1987, the year that I spoke with him. The West is legendary as a place for loners, drifters, and individualists. James Conaway told me about a man he met in Wyoming who fit the legend.
I call him a gunfighter. He calls himself a range detective. He's a man who has made his reputation with his gun. He could have stepped out of the 1870s. When I found him in a remote part of Wyoming where sheep rustling is still a viable career choice, he was hired by a rancher to more or less defend 30,000 acres. He has had a unique form of job security. As he told me, one ranch hires me and I run the rustlers off and they go next door and then they hire me. It's a quite incredible story, but he demonstrated how fast he was with his gun, first unloading it, then showing how he draws and shoots from the hip, performing a circular motion, a quite fluid experience, quite fast. Then he reloaded his gun and turned as if to go back into the house that he lives, and suddenly the gun was in his hand. It was literally faster than I could see. I saw something in his eyes, these cornflower blue eyes that I had not ever seen in a person's eyes before.
What?
It was a certain implacable, impersonal force that made the hair stand up quite literally on the back of my neck. Then the gun went off with a tremendous crash and a rock about the size of a 50-cent piece, 15 or 20 feet away, jumped up in the air. He had just nicked the upper corner of it, and he sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, "Shooting high today," and put the gun back in his holster and went in the house.
This is a fellow named Ed Cantrell, who you write about in The Kingdom and the Country. How did you meet up with him? Hadn't you heard a lot of stories about him before you actually found him?
Yes, I read a story about him being tried for murder in Rock Springs, Wyoming, about a decade before. And there was a newspaper story in a newspaper out west at some point where he had been interviewed, and the person who wrote the interview said something about his being a range detective in the area around Casper, Wyoming, but I could not find him. No one knew where he was. I called his lawyer. I called a person that he had worked for in another part of Wyoming who said, "Ed's a good man, but he likes to work alone." Eventually, somebody came up with an old telephone number of a ranch. I called the number many times. No one ever answered. I found myself in Wyoming doing another aspect of the book, and I said, "What the heck, I think I'll just go there and see if I can find him." And in fact, I did. I lucked out, and he was there, and we spent some time together, during which he showed me how to draw and showed me some of the other techniques that he uses in his business.
So is this a guy who just travels around the public lands looking for business?
Well, he travels around the West, as I said, from one ranch to another, and his job is to discourage people from rustling. Whether or not he actually shoots people doesn't seem to matter. It's really his reputation, and the point being that the West, in that sense, hasn't changed. Gunfighters always live by their reputation. They got more done and encountered more danger because of what they were reputed to be able to do rather than what they actually did. The power of guns is really what we're talking about, the prevalence of guns in the West. Guns were everywhere. Their import was much greater than the collective muzzle velocity, I think. But here was a person who actually made his living, if not using his gun, with the reputation of what his gun could do. And in that sense, nothing has changed in more than a century of the West.
We're featuring an interview from our archives with journalist James Conaway. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Conaway. He wrote about the American West in his book, The Kingdom in the Country. In your book, you suggest that the classic cowboys were closer to 19th century hippies than they ever were to the kind of John Wayne cowboy image that we have. Can I ask you to describe what you mean by that?
Well, cowboys have traditionally done dangerous, dirty, very difficult work. I didn't realize how difficult it was till I took part in a couple of roundups in the West. Probably the best cowboys today and the ones who are engaged in the most dangerous pastime are those who round up wild horses. This is a relatively small band of cowboys. They travel where the wild horses are, which is in the middle of vast tracts of public lands, usually in Nevada. That's the most common state. There are probably 40 or 50,000 wild horses out on the range. They're not easy to catch. You have to be a good rider, but you also have to be able to work in concert with a helicopter, which is used to corral them. The cowboys that I was talking about in the 19th century were people who were willing to take a bedroll and a change of clothes and get on a horse and ride from Texas to Montana. They didn't expect a lot out of life except freedom and the ability to do what they wanted to do. I think these men are like that today. The curious thing is that they are heavily dependent upon, in this case, American Express. The man that I was with owed American Express $50,000. He was living on credit, waiting to get paid for the federal government for all the horses he had rounded up. He and his partner had also wrecked two helicopters within the last 6 months. As he said, that makes the insurance companies real nervous. I asked the pilot how does one go about surviving a helicopter crash? Your chances are not very good, as you probably know. And he said, well, you just sit there and you wait till things stop flying around and then you jump out. So I pass that along in case you ever need it.
Yeah, I hope not. The 40,000 to 50,000 wild horses that you mentioned, I always figured that they were part of the legacy of the Wild West, but the way you explain it in your book, they're actually more of a legacy of the Depression.
Well, they are a legacy in a way of the Wild West. I mean, the horses came here, they came to the West, but they are envisioned by what I call the wild horse lobby, which is an urban phenomenon. It's not a Western rural phenomenon. They are envisioned as descendants of the mounts of the conquistadors, which is not the case. They are the descendants of nags that were turned out during the Depression because people couldn't afford to feed them. They are not, by and large, they are not beautiful animals. They are usually scarred. They fight a lot among themselves. They're not too healthy. They eat a lot more than a cow does. They're destructive to the range. The wild horse is a poor symbol of the wild and untrammeled West, and that the people who are supporting them, I think their sentiments are quite good, just misplaced. I wish they would shift their emphasis to the grizzly bear, which is a creature that really needs them, and is really the great symbol of what we're talking about here, a place where man's dominion is not complete and where there's still a chance to encounter something in the wilds that is bigger than we are.
Now, while we're on the subject of horses and cowboys, a lot of the cowboys now are using dirt bikes to herd cattle instead of horses.
Well, that's true. Dirt bike ranching is a real phenomenon in the West. I spent some time with a rancher in New Mexico, a fellow I liked quite a bit, although politically we didn't agree on much, but personally we got along quite well. He has not saddled a horse in 5 years. And I asked him one day why he preferred a dirt bike, and he jerked his thumb at his Honda that was parked in the shade of his house and said, "When that thing's setting there, it ain't eating," which I thought was one of the most eloquent descriptions that I'd ever heard.
So, I guess there's as much of a fantasy life around motorcycles as there is around horses, too, don't you think?
Absolutely. There's not much difference there. You spend, I guess the big difference is if you have a dirt bike, as a rancher, you spend a lot less time
grooming it.
that's right, and knowing it. And in fact, I think the person is diminished in the process, because a machine is not the same thing. An animal, you know, an animal has a personality. Horses are wonderful animals, and I think they lent a great deal to life in the West as we knew it. There are people who, however, who do spend more time on their machines than people ever spent on horses, and I'm talking about those who ride all-terrain vehicles, which are these three-wheeled jobs that will go almost anywhere in the West. These are urbanites who bring these machines out of places like San Diego and Los Angeles and other cities to romp in the wilderness, and they do more damage per square mile probably than anything other than strip mining. And at night, you cannot believe the matrix of flashing blue, green, red, and yellow lights that cover these sand dunes while thousands of people are competing, driving in all directions. There's no speed limit. There's no direction you can or cannot go in. People are constantly having accidents. There are horrible deaths as a result of this. It also seems to give rise to some sort of strange cultural manifestation whereby people torch public toilets and shoot occasionally Uzis through one another's trailers. It's an inexplicable phenomenon, and one that's terrifying but fascinating.
We were just talking about all the recreational dirt bikers that come in and tear up the land and all the subsequent battles that ensue around that. You describe in your book constant friction between the ranchers and the recreationalists in the public lands. Do the battles go beyond the dirt bikers who come in?
Oh, yes, I think they do. The battles, the dirt bikers often are competing just with the animals and the vegetation in the particular areas they use. Some of these areas are too remote, actually, to run cattle. But the conflicts over public lands are not limited to ranchers and recreationists. They go all the way up to people who strip mine coal in Montana, people who do seismic shooting to discover oil and gas deposits in various national forests. It's really I think it's in the end the question of who owns these lands and how they should be used. And it goes back in history as far as the white man has gone in the history of the West. Some people view the West as a national treasure that should in some ways be preserved. I'm not saying that you should have no development, should have no grazing. That would be foolish, but I think that the West, considering what has happened to the rest of the United States, that it has not had some public land laws to preserve it from development, shows that what we have in the West should be preserved as a national treasure. There are other people historically who have viewed the West as a place to plunder, whether they are miners or ranchers or whatever, and that those two basic positions are the ones that have been at war ever since we've had a West as we know it. They are at war today. You can say there's nothing new about it, but in fact the process has been greatly accelerated by numbers of people who live in the country, by the power of machines and by the demands for resources and the money it produces. So although it's an old argument and an old battle, it has a certain heightened poignancy now, in my opinion.
James Conaway recorded in 1987 after the publication of The Kingdom in the Country. His latest book is a memoir called Memphis Afternoons. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight, a special conversation about Robert McNamara's new book. The book is called In Retrospect, and the former defense secretary says the U.S. was wrong in its efforts in Vietnam. He believes, as early as 1963, he believed that the problems there could not be solved with American ground troops and with bombing campaigns. We'll talk about the book and the response with James Webb, who led a Marine rifle squad in Vietnam, was twice wounded, with former UPI reporter Joseph Galloway. We'll talk with Edie Meeks, a nurse who served in Vietnam, and also with David Harris. Once he was the president of the Stanford student body, and he served 2 years in prison for resisting the draft.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many people think that after Carl Perkins made rock and roll history with Blue Suede Shoes, his career fell apart with a bunch of lousy records. There were some bad ones, as rock historian Ed Ward points out, but he says there are also some overlooked masterpieces.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede.
To most people, Carl Perkins seems like a tragic one-hit wonder. Signed to Sun Records after his wife Valda heard Elvis on the radio and remarked that it sounded like what Carl and his brothers were playing in their band, he hit big with Blue Suede Shoes in January 1956. By then, Elvis had left Sun, and the label went full-time into making Carl Perkins a star. But that March, with the song at the top of the charts, Carl and his brothers were driving to New York to appear on Perry Como's TV show and had a bad wreck. Carl sat in the hospital and watched Elvis perform the song on TV instead. 2 years later, Carl was off Sun. Columbia, looking for the next Elvis, signed him. Unfortunately, like most major labels at the time, they had no idea what rock and roll really was. Blue suede shoes? Footwear. Here, Carl, record this.
Well, there's a brand new style going round. A hypnotizer, cats in town, living in a walking dream. A pointy toe and I saw what I mean, I said, pointy toes are coming back again, uh-huh. Pointy toes are coming back again. Liver things are eat when I got them on my feet, I say the point's coming back again.
That didn't get it. Well then, Tina Peril.
Well, she goes strutting down the street in her sophisticated style. The way she's dressed was knocking them wild. The cats started gazing till they called her out. Her pink pedal pushers was knocking them out. She wears a pink pedal pusher. Pink pedal pushers. Her pink pedal pushers has made her the queen of them all.
No, well, how about this?
Leave by a jacket. Shirt.
Poor Carl. He seemed like some sort of fetishist. And worse, Levi jacket and a long tail shirt didn't even have him playing guitar. And that's what he did best.
I'm a packing my suitcase. I'm a leaving this city. Don't I find me a girl?
Unfortunately, The Unhappy Girls in 1961 was one of his last records at Columbia. In those days of Brill Cream teen idols, he was an unruly hillbilly who rocked too hard, drank, and popped pills. He toured, played Blue Suede Shoes night after night, and was on the verge of quitting altogether when two things happened. Patsy Cline had a hit with So Wrong, a country song he'd written, and Well, the Beatles. They idolized him. They recorded his songs. In 1964, Perkins toured England and was treated like a god, and he cut some sides there with the Nashville Teens. It took him a while, but helped by Johnny Cash and his family, he got his life together, and in 1968, Carl had another hit.
Well, I walked up to the window, I said, give me a ticket, please. She said, where to, mister? I said, that's all right with me, honey, I'm just restless. I need to get on out of town, I need to go right now. Take me where the living's easy, baby, that's where I'll be found. I said, honey, till that driver put his big foot.
True, it was only a country hit, but it showed he still had it. Encouraged, he cut some country sides, which were beautiful, but weren't really hits. Today, Carl Perkins is healthy, happy, still married to Valda, and playing guitar better than ever. If you get a chance, go see him. He performs with two of his sons, and they'll make you believe that the Perkins guitar magic is hereditary.
Ed Ward is a writer now living in Germany. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurrock, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Updike, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from Random House, publisher of Alien Nation, Common Sense About America's Immigration Disaster by Peter Brimlow. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Terry Zwigoff, the director of a new documentary about underground cartoonist Ara Crumb. And we talk with Bill Griffith, creator of the comic Zippy the Pinhead, about Zippy and Griffith's trip to Cuba. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.